Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader in this new year of wonders, 2017. Today, our guest is Emily Fridland, author of History of Wolves, her first novel published just last week by Grove Atlantic. Emily holds a Ph.D. in literature and creative writing from the University of Southern California and teaches at Cornell. Her collection of short stories, Catapult, won the Mary MacArthur Award. Saraband will be publishing it this year. The first chapter of Wolves was published in Southwest Review and won the 2013 McGinnis Ritchie Award for Fiction. History of Wolves is a book about what I would ordinarily say is a little girl, Madeline, Maddie, or Linda, as she's known throughout the book. But I think she's really Madeline to me. But she's 14, though, and she's confused. She's empty. The book begins to fill her up for us, but in an unusual way, from her relationship to her parents, to her relationship with Lily, with Mr. Grierson, and with the gardeners, and with the land, with her dogs, with the water. What Linda becomes, and we see her through different lenses of time, is something that seems both familiar and yet alien. A fellow human being who we can relate to, but when we catch her out of the corner of our eyes, we sometimes see a wolf, or sadly sometimes a little girl being chased by a wolf. So welcome so much, and thanks for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So there's been so much buzz about the book that I've already casted Jennifer Lawrence as Patra and Chris Pratt as Leo. So in my mind, I have this all cinematically done.
That's fascinating. Interesting choices.
Well, so it's funny. When I first watched Linda look across the water to the gardener's house, it reminded me of The Great Gatsby, and it reminded me of looking at the pier in the green light. Do you see what I mean?
I do. That's really interesting. Gatsby is actually one of my favorite books, so I don't think it was directly on my mind when I was writing this, but I certainly had read it recently. I was in school when I wrote this book, and in graduate school, and I had maybe a little bit before I started the novel, I just recently reread Gatsby for a class, and had done some writing on it, so I'm not surprised that it might have found its way into the book one way or another.
Well, so funny, because last night I was reading an article about last lines of books, and, you know, So We Beat on Boats Against the Current, Borne Back Ceaselessly into the Past, they said is the best last line of a book, or a lot of people say that.
It is so good. It is really good.
And it reminds me of her, right?
Yeah, no, that's a great. I've never thought of that connection before, but absolutely, yeah, that feeling of trying to move forward, trying to escape in a way of our past, and just constantly being pulled back.
Well, when Linda's with her mechanic boyfriend, and he keeps kind of making fun of her, kind of saying, you know, you're going to end up going back and doing the same thing, you know, you're thinking, no, don't do that. And then she kind of does it, and that reminded me of that. You know, you can't blame a person, but sometimes they just can't help it, you know?
Yeah. There's a lot in the book about sort of this hunger to escape the lives that we're born into, and the sort of experiences that have shaped us. I think the first chapter kind of got me thinking about this, comes in the first chapter with Mr. Grierson and this teacher that comes to northern Minnesota and is sort of trying to escape something himself in his previous life in California. And I think something that Linda, Maddie, Madeline identifies with when she encounters him is that desire to escape, and the kind of fear that maybe you can't escape the things that you started with or that you began as.
What's really interesting about the way you write, and one of the reasons why there is so much buzz about the book, is because it's so intelligent, I think. And what you also do is you require a certain amount of discipline from the reader. So like when Mr. Grierson is looking at Lily, and Linda is aware of that and aware of why and why she's not going to be looked at like that, you kind of think, it's the first intimation in your mind of maybe Linda is looking at Lily kind of in the same way. And you, then I know, then it's like, I'm doing that. It's like, you're not doing that. Do you know what I mean there?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. That's a really, really interesting way of putting it. The ways in which an observer, which is, you know, largely what Maddie is, Linda is, and I'm going to call her Linda only because that's what is on the jacket of the book.
I will,
but
too.
I completely empathize and with your choice to call her Madeline, and part of me in my head always sort of thinks of her as Maddie, because that's sort of what Mr. Grierson calls it early on, and she sort of identifies herself that way. And so it's kind of a complicated thing to think about what to actually call her in the third person, but I'll call her Linda. But yeah, I think she's such an observer, and she's watching people watch, you know, and that kind of draws in the reader, and creates a kind of complicit space for everyone, right? It's hard to notice things and not participate. And that's part of the question of the book, I think, is what responsibility do we hold through watching or through witnessing?
Yeah, and the thing, again, with what you do with the reader and for the reader, because even though it's hard work, I think it's very beneficial in a book to have the reader stop and think and reread, or a day later think, oh, I get it. And it's like with Paul, there are so many tipping points for Linda in the book. There are moments when she can tip one way or the other, and as the reader, you're not sure which way she should tip. You are sure which way she should tip. You're either disappointed or not.
Right. Yeah, oh, you mean in her relationship to Paul?
Yeah, like with Paul, you know, it's like, well, first of all, Paul's as close as you come to magical realism in the book, because Paul's a very strange little boy who who has these almost powers. But but when she looks at him and when she deals with him, it's almost to the point where she's like back with her friend when she was little and she was in the commune. She can almost establish this relationship, but there's something that just constantly pulls her back. And again, it's hard for me to explain. I was interviewing this guy named Arturo Perez Reverte, and he describes things beautifully, just like you do when you discuss the fish under the water, barely moving, barely doing enough just to continue to exist during the winter time. He does the same thing, but he does it like with a guy getting dressed for a dinner party on a cruise ship and putting his Dunhill lighter in his pocket and his cigar cutter and his cigar, and you can see his clothes and you know the designer's name and you know him tying his shoes and all that. And I said to him, I said, it's amazing how you can do that. And he said, I don't do that, you do it.
Yeah, but the way in which there's some relationship established between reader and writer, is that sort of what you're referring to? And this,
yes, there is.
You're making meaning together. As a writer, I'm nudging things in directions that the reader is participating in, creating the meanings that are available, hopefully.
Well, the thing about you, and once again, the reason why this book will become so popular, I think, is because that relationship is established very, very clearly. And, you know, even when you look at the short story you wrote, I don't know, how many years ago, when you wrote Expecting, the short story Expecting.
Oh, did you read that?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's like
a long time ago. Yes, and that mm-hmm.
What a depressing story.
Oh, depressing. Oh, yes.
It's depressing, but it's like it's funny, it's depressing. And after you read it, you know, you have all these questions in your head as to how did this happen? How did that relationship between father and son happen? How did the relationship between the girl happen? And what happens is, I think, for some reason, the way you write, I mean, even like a few days, and someone else who read Wolves also, even a few days afterwards, like a lot of the reviews say, none of these characters are likable, particularly likable.
Right.
Or they'll say something about, and the end, or some people give away too much because there's lots of spoilers in this book. And one review gave away,
yeah,
I thought, something way too much, which I would never do. And but the thing about it is, a few days after you're reading, you might be having a cup of coffee and you go, oh, I didn't. Oh, yeah, now I see. But I think that's,
yeah,
like,
oh,
the
I
best
hope
thing.
That happens. I hope it happens. It certainly happens for me as a writer, right? I don't go in as a writer with a clear plan, you know, an outline. But I have a sense for where things are moving, and a sense of resonance between images and between characters and between scenes. And as I'm writing, yeah, several days will pass and I'll work on a scene and the meaning will reveal itself. And that's exciting. And I kind of hope the reader feels that too, that kind of gradual, emergence. Maybe that's a better way of putting it. The emergence of meaning rather than the delivery,
like,
of meaning.
It's like the game Clue sometimes in your book. It's like Colonel Mustard in the pantry with the candlestick. It's
right.
Like, and it's like when she takes her project and one of the judges says, what do wolves have to do with human history? And she says, wolves have nothing to do with humans. Actually, if they can help it, they avoid them. And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder right then if she realized she had a novel.
I didn't actually, but it took a little longer. I wrote that first chapter as a short story, and I've been writing short stories for years, and I put it away, and the voice of that story and the place really stayed with me, and so that's why I went back to it. But I do think, yeah, that piece, people have asked, you know, about the title and the metaphoric meaning of wolves, and it's, you know, wolves get so easily transformed into metaphor, I think, in our culture. But I often want to point them back to that line that you just quoted. I think, you know, that idea, that feeling that Linda has at that moment when she chooses wolves and her teachers are kind of sneering at her and the judges, and they sort of see it as something a teenage girl would do, you know, not very serious.
But it's almost like she says it in a defiant way. And,
yeah.
And it defines, at that moment, it defines her, at least for the reader, or at least for this reader.
Yeah. Yeah, there's something both kind of antisocial in it. Yeah, I mean,
yep.
So that's the point. The point about wolves is that they're not related to people. They're not interested in people. They're not people themselves. There's something antisocial in it, but there's also, so much of the history, the actual history that's delivered to teenagers, to young people, to especially girl teenagers, is one that is sort of about these sort of fixed hierarchies of power that just do not give them many options for authority. And I think Linda is drawn to wolves, like so many teenage girls are, potentially, like so many people are. But for Linda in particular, because she quotes a book about wolves that she's reading and says, you know, the alpha wolf can be alpha at different times based on different reasons, something to that effect. And that idea that the power is based on the context in which you're in and is not fixed over time is just really appealing, I think, to her in her life when she, as a person with so little power, but with, you know, wanting to use what power she has.
Yeah, and she accumulates power in some ways, and in other ways she divests herself of power throughout the book too. It's like alternating current or something.
Yeah.
But
yeah, what do you mean by that? Say more.
Because because, like with her boyfriend, she has power over him to a certain extent, mm-hmm. and she utilizes that power, not necessarily in the nicest or best ways, but he has power over her too. He can diminish her by hurting her where she can be hurt the most, and reminding her that, you know, she has a mindset that's going to perhaps irrevocably lead her back to a point where she really shouldn't be going. But
right.
she has the power to whatever, leave him, whatever, ignore him. And
yeah.
But the one thing where I think, and I don't want to get anywhere near spoiling anything, but in her letter to Mr. Grierson, in which she tells him what she tells him, especially in the last paragraph of that letter, and then he responds, and he responds in a, I think, kind of honorable way. And he describes two types of people who write letters like that to him.
Mm-hmm.
And the first type, and then he goes like, hey, just saying, you might be like the second type.
Right.
And then you take off from there.
Yeah.
And that's where the reader really gets excited, I think, because it's, I don't know, that was really a very powerful letter and a powerful response.
Yeah, I'm glad you felt that way. Yeah, I do think there are these moments throughout the book in which characters sort of get comfortable with being in positions of power and then are very quickly stripped of that power or that sense of knowing or having authority over other people or even over their own stories, their own understandings of their own stories. And I think you're right. I think Mr. Grierson sort of calls Linda on something that she can't see in herself in that letter, potentially, or can't say about herself, at least. And as does Rom, her boyfriend. And, you know, even Paul, going back to the idea of the wolf, at some point Linda takes, you know, the little boy Paul to see her beloved taxidermy wolf. She says, you know, I'm gonna show you a real wolf. And he takes a look at it and says, that's not real. And it's sort of, it, you know, despite all of the things that are true and so meaningful to Linda about wolves, the ideal of the wolf for Linda is just that too. You know, it's a story that she tells that's useful to her. Even Paul gets the collar on that at some point. So.
Yeah, and it's funny. Look how you do it too, because it repeats. And with Leo, for example, Leo is essentially omnipotent to Patra, and therefore vicariously omnipotent to Linda for a while. But yeah. Then his power diminishes to a cipher, and this is where you kind of, actually, basically, I'm trying to say that you kick the reader in the head a lot. And
oh, no, I'm sorry.
but like when she says to Leo, don't be a baby, Leo, when she says that, it's like, oh, my God, I can't believe she just said that.
Yeah.
And it's
well,
like,
go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, when she says that, it's like, how can she be so cruel, smart, intentional? You know, there was a lot in that line, an enormous amount in that line, perhaps the whole book to a certain extent.
Yeah, and in part, you know, she's reusing Leo's own words. That's why they hit him so hard. You know, she's caught Leo and Patra in this sort of sexual act, and she's revealing that she's seen them. Not to reveal too much, hopefully, about that scene. But yeah, there are moments when she sort of takes the language of others and repeats it back in a new context, uses people's words against them. I find that interesting. I think it happens all the time. And I think, those little constant shifts in power between people in conversation and in action. I just find that quite fascinating to think about.
Well, you must observe it too, because like when Grierson responded that way, I thought about situations in my life where I've done that, I've said something to somebody, kind of like reverse Schadenfreude, I guess, almost like, yeah, you're, yeah, that's fine that you did that. And then all I want is really to be absolved of the thing that I did. And the same thing with repeating something that maybe you shouldn't repeat, but you do it. She did it with intention, but sometimes I'm sure you have too, and I know I have. You know, you say something and you don't mean it to hurt, but it probably isn't something. It's probably something that would have been better off kept inside. And the book is full of those.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things I was thinking about a lot in this book too is just is storytelling and the ways in which people, you know, make the events of their lives add up in one way or another, and also try to recruit others to tell stories about that are sort of self-justifying. So, you know, certainly we see Leo doing that, and to some extent his wife Patra, but Indo too. I mean, she. You said earlier that she gains power and she loses it. But she, as she becomes more invested in this little family that she's babysitting for and becoming more involved with, there's a kind of giving up of power in becoming close and having a stake, an emotional stake, in a world that you care about, and also a kind of complicity and a desire to preserve the status quo. And, so as to keep your little measure of happiness, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, for sure. That idea of yeah, telling stories and thinking, trying to tell stories that you know, not even intentionally telling stories, but telling stories that are self-justifying or preserve the things that we care about.
Here's what I do as an interviewer, which is bad. I just like your book so much, I just want to talk about it. I forget that there's anybody listening. And then I remember that we're trying to sell your book. So here we have to go back to like the beginning, and I have to say to you, as if you're on Good Morning America or on Terry Gross or something, I have to say, so can you tell us a little bit about what your book is about?
Right. Which I actually find to be one of the harder questions of this book. But I will try my best. Basically the book, it's set in a remote part of northern Minnesota, and it takes the voice of an adult woman kind of looking back on a few really important and influential months in her life when she's 14 and 15. And basically, I should also say she's this woman was born into a back-to-the-land-style commune that kind of broke up when she was quite young, so she has very little memory of that commune. But she's still living in kind of the remnants that are left with the people that she thinks are her parents. And the plot sort of follows these two strands. One is her middle school history teacher, who is right in the beginning of the book accused of sex crimes, and then also her a family that moves in across the lake, and Linda becomes a babysitter for their little boy Paul, and sort of gets drawn into their world, and she, you know, in her ignorance, doesn't entirely see what's happening. But something is happening, and it's not going well for everyone in that family. So I'll leave it at that, maybe.
What decided you to bring in Chris? You know, and first of all, okay, well, why did you bring in the Christian Science aspect of the book, and why did you divide the book into those two sections of science and health?
Yeah, and again, without wanting to reveal too much from the plot, because the idea of religion is kind of an important piece, but is revealed gradually through the course of the book. So basically, the two sections are divided that way. In part, I wanted to give a little cue to the reader. There's also an epigraph at the beginning from Science and Health, Whiskey Scriptures by Mary Bagherity, which is a seminal text in Christian Science. So that's a little cue to the reader, and the two sections are divided, Science and Health, with those titles. I always thought of the first half of the book. The whole book is told in retrospect, but I always thought of the first half of the book as a little bit more closely aligned with the young Linda, the 14 or 15 year old girl, because the reader would have the experience of sort of encountering the world as she sees it, with just these little hints of retrospect, but without the knowledge that would make those events add up and make sense. And then the second half of the book, Health, is a little bit more closely aligned with Linda as an adult, looking back. And so the reader has that experience of knowing what happens, just as Linda would as an adult looking back on the events of her life. So it's kind of playing with and thinking through how knowledge changes, how we make meaning and how we understand what happens. And I always sort of thought of science, I was sort of playing in the beginning, that first section, with the idea of science as sort of suggesting that encounter through observation, without a lot of interpretation. And then health is just being a way of thinking about how do we diagnose, how do we try to make things that we observe add up to something, that we can make sense of and possibly do something about.
Well, that's so hard to do when you say that. When you say it like that, it sounds like it's eminently doable, but how do you, when you're working with the very tool that's either flawed or non-existent or messed up in some way, how does one go about, and, you know, Linda fails, succeeds, whatever, but how do you go about observing yourself and then attempting to modify yourself in a positive way?
I don't know. I don't know the answer to that question. That's a great question. I don't know. Part of the reason I wanted to kind of play with perspective a little bit in the book is I think it's so easy when you look at certain situations from the outside to say, I know what I would do in that situation, right? I wanted that first part of the book to really position the reader in Linda's experience and to create that sense of, you know, her incredible isolation, her incredible longing, her ache, her aching for connection, and just the remoteness of her experience makes it really hard for her to see, for at first even see what's happening, despite the fact that she's incredibly observant. She has a hard time even seeing it. And then ultimately, because she's so invested in the world that she's found for herself, it makes it ultimately really hard, excruciating for her to consider doing something to destroy that world. And I just wanted the reader to feel that, that pain and that struggle. And to see that people, you know, so many of these characters, you know, they do terrible things, but they're not terrible people. You know, they do terrible things out of good intentions and, out of hunger to be loved and to love. And that's kind of what I was thinking about, I guess. That makes sense to you.
It does make sense, because the whole thing is about putting it in simple words, which don't mean really anything big right now. It's just the whole thing is about wanting to be wanted. Want it more than anything. And
right.
It's Leo's kind of a pain. Leo's a pain in the ass from the beginning. He's not necessarily a bad person, but he is what he is. The one person who really doesn't have any flaws at all is Lily. But
Do you think so, really? No flaws?
Well, of course she has flaws, but she's much more innocent Patra's innocent, too. Oh, wait a minute. I don't know. I'm all confused. But
they're all sort of innocent, I would say. I would argue. But they're also all sort of complicit as well.
Well, the mechanic is not innocent. And he's just kind of pragmatic and has a decent
yes.
head on his shoulders.
Fair enough. Fair enough. Totally. I agree with that one. Yeah, you know, I mean, I've seen that, too. People have said to me, Lily seems the most innocent. And then I think, but, you know, she told this elaborate lie that actually did legitimate harm to a person who, you know, who was not a good person himself, Mr. Grusin, her teacher, but actually did have an effect. It's hard to blame her because she used, you know, she's using whatever little tool she has to escape her difficult life, and you know, she only has one ace in her hand, and that's her beauty, and she's using it. So it's hard to blame her for that, but I think that's part of where Linda's anger at the end of the book comes from. I mean, she's angry at Lily, and she sees, you know, she sees something similar between Lily and Patra in this pattern of telling stories to get what you want. You know, telling yourself stories to get what you want or need.
But like you said, when she talks about, and I think I'm getting this right, when she talks about, you know, you go back, you try to remember, well, when finally we realize, hey, she's old now, older, when you go back trying to reconstruct what happened in the past, it's not like anything that happened in the past at all. And it reminds me of Julian Barnes, The Sense of an Ending, when you kind of did something when you were young and you thought this is what you did, but then later when you revisit it, you realize how much harm you caused and what you had done was so much worse than what you thought you had done. And she has a moment, too, when she's thinking about her bike ride back to town and the circuitous route that she took.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, yeah, sort of in a similar way to Lily, it's hard to blame her for, you know, she doesn't have, Linda has so few resources, and if she's going to stop the tragedy that's unfolding before her, you know, she doesn't have a lot of tools with which to do that. But she has some, and she has some opportunities, and she doesn't take them.
I know who was really bad in the book, the bad character.
Okay, who's really bad?
The cheerleader. I forgot her name.
The cheerleaders. Oh, the Karens?
The one who was behind the counter at the end.
Oh, Sarah, the ice skater, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Ice skater, yes, yeah.
Yeah, Sarah the ice skater.
Yeah, she was.
Okay, well, yeah, no, she's hard to sympathize with, maybe. That's true, that's fair, and she's a bit of a bully,
And she's scared at the end, but that's so funny, too. It's funny that you were able to bring some humor out in this, and it's there, and you can see it, but you don't expect it, but... You're not even sure whether you should be amused.
No, it's a funny scene. No, I think so. I hope it's a little bit funny.
It was.
But you know, part of the way I think of humor is just the absurdity of it. I wanted a couple of moments. Also, the playing Candyland or Leo tucking in his shirt. They're not funny, haha. I don't think, but absurd. You know, in that way. That sometimes, you know, tragedy, extreme tragedy, can bring out absurdity.
Oh yeah, and tucking in his shirt, that was cool too, because the way you really did stuff a lot in here. It's like,
what do you think?
You really did stuff a lot into this book, like, because when you think about it, the way Patra fell in love with Leo is because of that. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. No, it doesn't make any sense. She just. Yeah, I know. It's one of those. She felt like she could predict it, and she knew he was going to do it before he did it, and that made her, you know, feel like she knew him. And it's one of those just little things, you know. We fall in love with people for the strangest reasons, but yeah, that's one of the things that helped, you know, made her.
I guess that's why, like, you know, when you. Do talk about the buzz and all this stuff, which I have a love-hate relationship with all this buzz stuff. But
I hate the word buzz. I have to admit, I don't even know what to make of it.
Neither do I. But when they talk about that, I guess it's because you do things like that. So a guy tucks his shirt in with intention, and he does it every single time. And because of that, someone who's much younger than him and might not should be having a relationship in the first place with him, but is, falls in love with him, or thinks she falls in love with him for that. And the reason why it's good is because everybody has been through that experience.
Mm.
Every adult has been through an experience similar to that and can identify with it. And the thing about it is you explain it so well that the reader doesn't have to make any leaps or anything. It's just like seamless. Like I go, oh yeah, I remember when I had that relationship and the same thing happened, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I'm glad you feel that way.
It's hard to do.
The vast majority of my life as a writer is just spent, you know, sitting. This is true for most writers, I assume, but you're sitting and just thinking about things that intrigue and fascinate you, and that seem worth writing about. And so, it's always a relief to hear that maybe others might find those things a little bit interesting as well. So, yes. Or and then those things might make sense outside your own head, you know.
Well, it's funny because in like semi-researching, if you will, getting ready for this, I was looking at Goodreads and looking at all the hundreds and hundreds of reviews of the book. And a lot of them are like the way I felt. Like some of them will go, like, I didn't know what to say about this book. I was going to give it 3 stars, but then I decided to give it 4. I was going to give it 4 stars, but then I decided to give it 5. And they all have the same thing. Like they came back, you know, they thought about it for a while and then they go, oh, well, yeah, I didn't realize that. Or I didn't think that Mr. Grierson's story really kind of went with the book. And then they realized, oh, yeah, it obviously goes with the book.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, you do that. It's like the game Clue. It really is.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say it's unusual, and that's why I found it such a good book, because it's unusual that those skeins of character and story, which at first may seem disparate and not connected, especially the way the book ends, which I'm not saying anything else other than the way the book ends, it does seem to bring a lot of strands together that you might have thought during the reading might not be able to be brought together.
Yeah, I hope so. I think as a reader, it is a pleasure to be in that relationship, and to go back to what we were talking about earlier with a writer, to be kind of building meaning together. And as a writer, I'm always thinking about, you know, there's this tug or this push-pull relationship that I'm imagining, my imagined reader, whatever that is, whoever that is, in which you sort of want to meet expectations and you also want to push back against them, and that creates this kind of wonderful tension that I find sort of interesting to think through. And the other thing I say is I'm totally fascinated by the idea of silence or the unspoken or the unsaid. And so much of writing for me often is about, you know, kind of trying to define the negative space a little bit, trying to figure out what to say to point out what is not said, if that makes sense to you.
Yes, I was just going to say.
So, yeah, so that's something I've been thinking a lot about. You know, and it can fall the other direction, too. Sometimes you say too little and there's too much negative space and then the reader's left floundering, right?
It depends on whether you're good at creating it, whether you're like E.E. Cummings or whether you're not. You know, it's just
right.
it's just being the writer that you are, and it just so happens that you ended up being a hell of a good one. Otherwise, this would have sucked. but it was great. The one thing that's interesting to me about the characterization is that some people are born like fully integrated, like Buddha babies, like bodhisattvas, like my daughter. And she is just what she is. She isn't anything else. She's Annie. And she's totally integrated, so she doesn't ring like a bell like I do all the time. And, you know, I feel like at the center of myself, you know, there's something that should be there but probably isn't there for a reason, and it would be nice if that could be filled. But you meet in your life, and you meet them very few times, people who are totally themselves and nothing else. Mm. And I think, in summary, the book is about, it's a shame that she wasn't, and it would have been nice if she could have been, and then it's up to the reader to find out when they read the book whether she does or she doesn't, right?
You mean whether she becomes integrated?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I don't know. That's not exactly right, I don't think. I didn't say that right. Tell it the way it is.
Tell it the way it is. I agree with you. I probably am inclined myself to be the person who is always feeling that absence or that negative space and trying to figure out how to fill it. And that creates movement, right? And that creates tension, and it creates stories, and it creates narrative, and it does a lot of great things, because you're searching, you're moving in the world. And I see that in Linda. This hunger drives her, literal hunger and emotional hunger. But it's not clear to me that she ever, that's something that reader can decide.
Yeah.
Through that journey.
It's difficult to interview about this book, because there really are a lot of spoilers, and they occur at different points in the book. And there's, you know, a couple of really big ones. And like I said, one of the reviews, I think, said too much. But, so it's hard to discuss the actual facts, because a lot of them lead to telling the story, and telling the story is really doing a potential reader a disservice in this book, don't you think?
Say that last part again.
Like, if you tell too much of the story of this book, you really do a disservice to the potential reader, I think.
Yeah, you know, that's why I said, when you said describe it, I've actually found that really difficult.
But that's what's but everyone's going to ask you that.
I know, I have to get good at it. But it actually, it feels a little bit, honestly, it feels a little false, because what I'm saying is not really what the book's about, exactly.
Nope.
And the only way you can know what the book is about is to go through the experience of finding out what the book's about, because it, to me, what the book's about is how it's told. You know, it's how the story is told. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Not what it's about, but how.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying is so great. But I'm not trying to compliment you by saying that over and over again. I'm just saying that's what's so that happens to be what's so great about the book. It's the way the story is told. The story itself is a great story, but it's one that could be told in lots of different ways. And it could be told in one way where it just unfolds and it's clear what happens. But instead, not to belabor the point, instead, the way you've done it, the reader has to actually engage in a certain amount of mental exercise to make sure that he dots the I's and crosses the T's and inserts tab A into slot B and all that stuff. Some readers don't like that. They'd rather have Jodi Picoult or something, you know?
No, I know. I completely agree. That's why, I mean, honestly, you know, I've spent years writing these little literary stories, and it's, so when you use the word buzz, it's confusing to me, because I don't know what it means to have readers just fall into my work. You know, it's not, I never thought of myself as a really easy writer, like a fun escapist writer.
Well, what's going to happen is I'll get you to come back when the paperback is released, after you've already sold the movie rights, and then you're going to be like a real big shot.
No, I'm sure that probably won't happen. But okay, I'll come back for sure if you want.
Okay. Well, with that, I think I've pretty much exhausted it and probably made you talk more about things than you wanted to. But I just wanted to tell you how much I enjoyed it and I guess basically how different it was. And it's hard to find books that are different nowadays. In fact, I own an independent bookstore, and it's really difficult when I look at my front table to see stories that approach things in a different way. And yours definitely did, and it'll have a nice prominent place on the front table.
Oh, I really appreciate that. And your questions were so thought-provoking. And so I enjoyed the conversation a lot. Thanks.
Likewise. So we were talking with Emily Fridland about her book, The History of Wolves. We had a great chat, and I really enjoyed this book. I strongly recommend it. It's probably going to be one of the best sellers of this year, and I really honestly do think it'll be made into a great movie. So continue to join us every week on The Avid Reader for what I think, especially this interview, is an insightful and engaging discussion. It's the beginning of the year, and Rebecca has already lined up tons of people. University of Pennsylvania professor Lisa Servon, who's going to discuss her, I consider, groundbreaking work, The Unbanking of America, very relevant for today's politics and economic situation. How the New Middle Class Survives, The Unbanking of America. Critically acclaimed writer Josh Barkin, and will discuss his latest collection of short fiction, Mexico Stories. And debut novelist Erica Forensic will discuss her thriller suspense novel, The River at Night. We have plenty more after that, too, but for a complete schedule, visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com as usual, or you can simply download the podcast at iTunes or Podomatic. So this was a great interview. I really enjoyed it. History of the Wolves by Emily Fridland. And continue to come and stop by and listen to the next interview here on The Avid Reader.